We have been talking about sacrifice and atonement, and we started on this because one of the things that, I'm going to get me something to drink here. Oh, it's empty. All right. Well, I guess I'll just have to hurry up then, huh? So we're talking about sacrifice and atonement, and part of the reason why I wanted to go into this particular conversation and talk about this subject is because one of the things that we are experiencing in our society, what's going on today, is a conversation about people who are divided. And it doesn't quite matter what your opinion is. It doesn't quite matter where you stand on these different issues. The fact of the matter is, you understand that there is division going on around you, right? And it could be your neighbors, it could be within your family, it could be anywhere. And whenever you have these divisions, whenever you have these grievances, whenever you have people who are angry, they feel hurt, or they feel left out, or they feel like something has not been done for them, or something wrong has been done to them, anytime that happens, and we can appreciate this as Christians, if we're honest, because we know that we're sinful. We know that we make mistakes. We know that an atonement has to be made. We know that a sacrifice was made. That is exactly why we take the bread and we take the cup, because we understand that somebody had to make a sacrifice. You know, and back in the Old Testament, they had, you know, bulls and goats, and they sacrificed animals. But God got to a point, he said, that's enough bloodshed. You know, you end up killing all the animals because there's so much sin. Atonement has to be made. And I want to personalize this, which is why I want to talk about this subject. I want us to be able to relate to this in a very personal way in our own lives. And so that's why I want to go into this conversation. And so I've given this title to the sermon today. It's called The Talk. The Talk. Now, little insight here. Those of you all who may be nosy enough to follow me on social media may know that a few days ago, I'll tell you a quick story. My son, he plays Fortnite, right? And he loves playing Fortnite, and that's kind of been over the past 3 or 4 months. That's what he and his friends have been doing, is playing a lot of Fortnite. Thank you. And the thing about Fortnite is a, you know, I mean, he's old enough. He's 11, so, you know, they do a lot of shooting and stuff like that. But the point is, it's not particularly graphic or gruesome, but it is something that a lot of kids are into. And so this has been his way, because you can talk on the little microphone, and during the gaming, you can talk to your friends. So this is how he's been staying connected with his friends. So it's less about the video game and as much as it is about the fact that he's online with his friends and they're staying connected with one another. And I'll hear him talking to them, and sometimes it's really late because, you know, bedtimes have gotten a little bit skewed with the coronavirus. But my son, he comes up to me. This was Friday. He says, "Hey, when you were a kid, do you remember a song called Never Gonna Give You Up?" And I said, "Never Gonna Give You Up." And immediately, like, 30 other questions came to my mind. I'm thinking, I know he's not talking about Barry White. So I said, "Barry White?" He was like, yeah, Barry White. And I said, wait a minute. This boy's 11. First of all, I don't even know I think Barry White died before he was born. What is he doing? Listen, I'm thinking, I know they're not listening to Barry White. Like, but somebody, one of his friends, has on their playlist that they're playing the music while they're playing the game, and it comes on. He said, "Was that out when you were little?" I said, "Yeah, I was very, very, very little, son. I know of Barry White, but I'm thinking to myself, like, why?" And so immediately I thought to myself, because I've been planning this for some time, right? I said, I'm going to have the talk with my son. I'm going to have this conversation, not just in passing. We've had conversations before. I said, I'm going to have this actual conversation. You know, some of you all, you know, back when you were young, it was called the birds and the bees talk. Well, I've officially called it the Barry White talk now, because this boy brought up Barry White. So I'm talking to him about it. And so Sharice and I and Kendall, we were all getting ready to go out to the store. And I said, you know what? Actually, William and I are going to go, because I had to go pick up a grill. So I'm going to go to, William and I are going to Home Depot. Kendall wants to go, and I want to go. I'm like, no, Kendall. Me and the boy got to have a little man time. Because we got to talk about where he got his Barry White thing from, right? Never going to give you up. So we're having this conversation. And I'm asking him different questions. And I'm like, so what do you know about sex? Tell me what you know about sex. And he gives me some responses. And I'm thinking, okay, I guess we can start from there, you know. And then we get to talking about a little more details and how you got to understand that sex is something that is, the reason why it matters so much is because you don't want to be irresponsible. You know, it can be very dangerous. It can be very hurtful. It can cause a lot of other problems. So we're going into all these things that I won't go into right now. And it was so funny because I didn't know this was going to be the end of the conversation, but right as we got towards the end of the conversation, he says, so you're telling me all this. He said, oh, that makes sense now, right? Because he says something about a cycle. I'm like, and he said, like a period. I said, oh, okay, yeah. And so then we're talking about eggs and ovulation, all this kind of stuff. And so, exactly, we went there. So finally he says, Dad, if that wasn't bad enough, he says, so are you an expert, Daddy? Do you know, like, everything? And there was about five other ways I could have answered. I said, well, son, I know quite a bit. He says, did you ever experiment and do any of these things? And I said, actually, son, yeah, I experimented a lot more than I probably should have. Now, I didn't get into all the experiments because I didn't want to give him a bunch of ideas. But the point was, this conversation, as much as it could have been uncomfortable, frankly, I was looking forward to having this conversation. Because the last thing I want is for my son to learn about sex from the world and from his little friends who are listening to Barry White. I don't want my son to learn about sex from the internet. I don't want some teacher or some other adult, some coach, maybe some person that he trusts. I don't want them to have this conversation. This conversation is too important. And as much as I may have wanted to find a different time to have this conversation, the fact of the matter is, it's not dictated on my terms and when I'm ready. The conversation presents itself when it's time for it to happen. And I'm grateful because one of the things in talking to him, I think about my experiences. My parents, and this is no shame on it, my parents didn't have that conversation with me until it was way too late. I was already involved sexually with way too many things to the point where it was kind of damage control by the time we had that conversation. And I said, I don't want to wait for that. And, you know, somebody even asked me this. They responded. They said, oh, wait till it's your daughter. I said, no. When it's time for us to have this conversation, A, I'm going to direct them to Sharice. I'll probably just turn into Mufasa, some giant lion, and I'll just yell at her, you better not. And then I'll walk away sad. Because my little baby girl, my daughter, will suddenly have reached that stage where she has developed and she's changing. But when we think about the talk, and I want to go into this, I'm not talking about this show, right? There's a show, anybody who watches CBS knows the talk, you know. But we're not talking about this talk. And this is kind of what I was getting into. You know, this is a book called It's Not the Stork. You know, this is a conversation to introduce your kids to the realities that it's not fairy tales and fables, but that sex talk, it's a very real thing, right? And yet, this is not what I want to talk about over the next few minutes today. This is a documentary series that PBS introduced, The Talk, Race in America. It talks about conversations. See, these are conversations I had to have as a black boy growing up, about how to handle yourself, how to understand there's a reason why you don't do certain things. This is an introduction into racism. This is an introduction into how to behave when you're in certain company. what to do. And this is long before cell phones. See, we can keep track of our kids a little better, and they can call us if they're in trouble. This was before that. I had to get step-by-step procedures on what to do if I caught myself in a situation, because not only was I a black boy, but I went to school with mostly white kids for the vast majority of my childhood. And so there were lots of situations that came up. And so my parents, both my mom and my dad, they talked to me about structural racism, systemic racism, things that were happening that I need to be aware of. But I want to broaden this out, because what I want to talk about is not these talks. And I want to look at Jesus in John chapter 5 and a talk that he was willing to have that we have to be willing to have too. John chapter 5, starting in verse 1, it says, "Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, 'Do you want to get well?' 'Sir,' the invalid replied, 'I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I am trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me.' Then Jesus said to him, 'Get up, pick up your mat, and walk.' At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, 'It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat.' But he replied, 'The man who made me well said to me, pick up your mat and walk.' So they asked him, 'Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?' The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, 'See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you.' The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well." I chose this particular passage out of many other ones that I could have chosen, because I feel like it encapsulates, frankly, a talk, a conversation that we have to be willing to have as a church. Because lots of times we dance around it, or we avoid it, or we come at it indirectly. And I look at Jesus in this scenario, and one of the questions that doesn't often get asked, but it points out that he was there for 38 years, languishing, just doing the same thing over and over again, never having anyone to help him get into the pool. People believed back then that when the water would get stirred, that was the time when the Spirit was moving, and that you had to get in, and the first one to get in would be healed. And he said, every time I tried to get in, there was nobody to help me get in first. So he was living in this existence. And the question that often needs to be asked but doesn't get asked, what happens if Jesus doesn't come up to him and have this conversation? What becomes of this man? Does he ever get in the pool? Does he ever get better? Is he ever made whole, where he can pick up his mat and walk? No matter how many times I read it, I find it fascinating that everybody knows that this man is an invalid, and yet the first time they see this man walking, carrying his mat, the question they have is, why are you carrying your mat on the Sabbath? Not, how did you, after almost four decades, get up and change so quickly? But the fact is, he can, in fact, change that quickly, because the power that Christ had to be able to heal him made it so that all the muscle atrophy, all the soreness, all the weakness, all of that was put aside. All he had to do was make a decision to get up and walk. He then tells him, he says, see that you're well, again, stop sinning or something worse may happen to you. But again, I point out this particular story because when we read this, the question that we have to ask ourselves as a church is, are we willing to have that conversation? You know, it was interesting, Marcos, you all met Marcos, most of you have, my friend, who he's spoken here a couple times. One of the things he said, you know, I don't know if I would post that on social media. I don't want your son to be embarrassed. And my first thought was, by the time my son even knows that I mentioned that we had this talk on at Home Depot, he'll be so old and you know, it won't even matter. But more to the point was the fact, I was telling him, I said, you know, there's a lot of men who are afraid to have that conversation with their kids. They're nervous. They're uncomfortable. They don't want to talk about what they did and the mistakes that they made. They don't want to get involved in this conversation because it makes them a little squeamish. There's men out there that are willing to fight, willing to go to war, willing to die for their country, but they're not exactly comfortable having this conversation with their own sons and daughters. And, you know, what's even worse is that on the flip side of this, there are people who will look at their kids if their daughter goes out and gets pregnant or their son goes out and gets someone pregnant. They get a sexually transmitted disease. They get in some trouble. They end up getting arrested or they have a problem because someone accuses them of sexual assault or some type of sexual misconduct. They're sending pictures. All of this stuff is happening. And as a church, we can look at that person and say, but that's your son, that's your daughter. Why wouldn't you want to have that conversation? Why wouldn't you want to introduce this? Why wouldn't you want it to be you? As important as this is, and why wouldn't you want to do it with love and care and with authority and with passion? Why wouldn't you want it to be you, even if it does make you uncomfortable? See, as a church, the reason why I make this parallel is because very often there are conversations happening all around us. We see it on the news. You see it on the internet, you read about it in the paper. People are talking about it in barbershops and hair salons, and they're talking about it on different networks. We know these conversations are happening, but sometimes as Christians, we're like, that's not the conversation we want to have. We want to talk about doctrine. We want to talk about all of the things that matter to us, not realizing that what God is trying to say is actually what should matter to you is the conversation that they're having. Why? Because they're the ones who are lost. They're the ones who don't know. They need you to have this conversation. They don't need you to run away from the conversation. So many people, think about Jesus is talking to this man. He's been there for 38 years. How many people talk to him along the way? How many people in 38 years walk right past him and never ask him how long he had been there? What can I do to help you get there? You know, we could read about the Good Samaritan. We could read a bunch of different stories. But this is so appropriate for what we're dealing with right now because as a church, in this story, one of the things I was taught when I was a kid was whenever you read the Bible, find yourself in the story. And in the story about this man who's laying at the side of this pool waiting for somebody to help him, in this story, we're the paralyzed. We're the invalid. The church is the invalid. We've been crippled. We've been going along. We know, everybody knows, that the church is in decline. They're losing numbers. There are whole generations that are not interested in the church. They'll say things like, I'm spiritual, I believe it as God, but I don't feel like I should invest my time and energy and resources into the church. Why? Because somewhere, right or wrong, they feel like the church has failed them. The church is not relevant. And rather than having the conversation that is on the minds of these people who are dealing with these things, we want to talk about other stuff. And so then it's like, well, maybe we should just, you know, change our worship service. Maybe we should have instruments. Or maybe we should change the song books and sing more relevant songs. Or maybe we should look into how we have leadership. Maybe we should do some adjustments or consider. And we'll literally have whole workshops and think tanks on women leadership. And there are different groups out there that are talking about homosexuals and what our position is on that. And the fact of the matter is, that is not going to change what is really at issue. What is really at issue is, are we willing to have the conversation? Not, are we going to change something structurally? Because the church isn't losing relevance. There aren't whole generations that aren't interested in the church because we don't have a band. There aren't whole generations that aren't willing to come here because we don't have better food at potlucks and cookouts. That is not what matters. The conversation that's been going on and dominating us for months now is coronavirus. And now it has shifted to a conversation that I had when I was a kid. It's been going on for decades. It's been going on for centuries. But we don't want to have that conversation about racism. Or if we do, we want to have it limited, or we want to talk about it in bits and pieces, or we'll be very defensive about it. And we don't want to just deal with the fact that, just like when my son asked me, are you an expert? Part of me wanted to say, go ask your mama. But that would have been totally wrong to put her on the spot like that. And the larger point in all of that is, I don't have to be an expert to talk to my son about sex. I don't have to be a professional or a scholar. You don't have to be a professional. You don't have to have researched and read every book by some leading national authority on race. Or you don't have to be an authority on, I don't know, diseases and pandemics to be able to talk to people about things that are relevant to their lives. We have to ask ourselves as a church, are we willing to get up off the ground, pick up our mat? Because it's not some long process that we have to take over the course of the next 10 years to get to a place where the church can be relevant. We could be leading as a church. We could be leading when it comes to this conversation. But it's a decision that we have to be willing to make. To save the lost and help younger generations see Christ, we have to speak to what matters. What matters to them? I put up this slide. You know, it's interesting. I told you about Fortnite, right? And I remember I had to do my research. My son wanted to buy this game. He wanted to get it. And I said, okay. And you know, I got it for him. And I said, I've got to watch him play this. I need to see. I need to, you know, kind of eavesdrop and listen. Because I have no intention. I even tried to play it. I wasn't successful. But the fact is, I had to learn this enough to feel like I can trust this thing. I don't have to be an expert at Fortnite to know what my son is doing. This is another one. TikTok. I was like, what is a TikTok? My daughter wanted to get this on her phone. My daughter has like 7 numbers in her phone. She doesn't talk to anybody except for like 3 of her friends, me, her mom, my sister, and like my mom and my dad. So that's 8 people. That's it. Right, she may have a couple people here in the church. I think she may have Miss Linda's number or something. The point is, no, it's Miss Janet. The point is, her phone is strictly there for her to be able to talk to her couple of friends and be on certain apps. I need to know what apps she's on. Not be an expert. I mean, this may come as news to some of you. I'm not an expert on sex. I still have to have that conversation. I'm not an expert on TikTok. I still have to be willing to have that conversation. I'm not an expert on race. I still have to be willing to have that conversation. I still have to be willing to talk. I still have to know, because how else will young people, this is the conversation they're having. What am I going to say? No, I'm not going to talk to you about things that are interesting to you. This is strictly for illustration purposes. This is an example, I saw this, of 10 different apps that teens are using that parents need to know about. The reason why they matter is because these are apps that while they seem benign on the surface, they're actually there for bullying. They're actually there for shaming people. They're actually ways for people to have conversations about sexual things that they can then hide from their parents. There's one of them is actually called Calculator. That's the one up here on the top. This app looks like a calculator but functions as a secret photo vault. This way, if you're sending photos that are inappropriate between people and then your parents come in the room, you can just hit the little button. This is what's happening. If I don't get to my son and he's 11, it's not even a matter of whether or not I feel comfortable. The church, Christ, are we relevant? How can I be relevant to my son later if I haven't been willing to have the conversation with him now? As a church, for us to seek and save the lost, we have to look at this and ask ourselves, are we willing to have those conversations? I want to share a really quick story. I'm going to read this. I got this from several people yesterday. This is a picture. There were several pictures put in there. But there was a guy who wrote a blog post. And I'm just going to read through this here. Bear with me a couple minutes. He says, his name is Scott Lloyd. I don't know Scott Lloyd, but this got sent to me, and this will make sense here in just a minute. It says, a letter to Roy. He's the black guy in my pictures. It says, dear Roy, you are a friend of my youth. You're black and I am white. When we became adults, we drifted apart. You served in the military. I served in the ministry. You died too soon for me to tell you this in person, so I'll tell you now. You endured more than you should have, suffered more than you deserved, and you were held to the unreasonable expectations of white culture, yet still you were my friend. You came to my all-white church. You stayed in my white home. You ate at my white table, yet I never stayed at yours. An occasional visit to your world was all that my whiteness could warrant, yet you were expected to live in mine. I was in your presence when the N-word was used on multiple occasions. I said nothing. You ignored it while others laughed at your expense. You were teased by folks in the church, mocking your blackness, pretending to be welcoming. We wore our whiteness that arrogantly paraded unceasingly before you. We expected you to conform to our culture because we thought it superior. We saw ourselves as the savior your community needed, that you needed. We deceived you with pictures of white Jesus and never told you the truth that he was black. Jesus was more like you than he was like us, yet we pretended otherwise because to do differently would have elevated you above us, and we couldn't have that. People shook my hand and patted me on the back. How good of you to befriend this black boy, they said, without even acknowledging you standing there. My white world treated you as normal, a novelty, tolerated only as long as you were obedient, subservient, and didn't try to date any of the white girls in the youth group. In retrospect, I now know that my white world abused you, stifled you, truncated your growth and experience. Long before Eric Garner or George Floyd cried, "I can't breathe," all us white folks were stealing your oxygen. You sung our songs, read our Bible, believed our gospel, all of which were stolen 100 years earlier from another black man at Azusa Street. We never told you his story. We only told you ours. Perhaps it was a saving grace that you were spared the turmoil in this world today. Had you been given time to reflect on the harm brought to you by my culture, you may have justifiably lost your mind, leading to a compounding of your suffering. You would have been justified in your anger at how you were treated, marginalized, ignored. You were present in my world but remained largely invisible, only seen on the occasions we wanted to justify our sins by pointing to your body as a token of our righteousness. We were hypocrites and fools. You were patient and endured our taunts longer than you should have. Ironically, many white folks reading this that shared our history will remember all of this differently. They will recall how kind you were, how kind we were to you, how we paid your way to youth camps, bought you meals, had you in our home, and were gracious enough to include you in all of our activities. We treated you like family, they will protest, refusing to reflect on the motivations of why we chose to do so, refusing to confront the arrogance of assuming that you should come to us to learn, because we know better than you. Roy, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry that I didn't know better, that I didn't do better. I'm sorry that I'm just now saying this years after your death. I'm listening now. I'm learning now. I'm speaking up now. I hope you can hear me. I love you, Scott. Now, it was interesting because the handful of people I got that sent that, the people who sent that to me, I know why they sent that to me. Because in many ways, because I went to all white schools, because I was a part of a church where there were a lot more white people than there were black people, people just assumed that that was my experience. And I'll be honest with you, there were a lot of experiences that I can relate to, like Roy. But fast forwarding to today, he says, I'm sorry that I didn't listen. I'm sorry that I didn't understand. What he's saying is, I'm sorry that I didn't want to get out of my comfort zone and deal with this thing. I didn't want to talk to you about it. There are people's salvation that is on the line, and it is depending on us. Doesn't matter if you're black. Doesn't matter if you were once somebody who was racist. Doesn't matter if you're somebody who harbors animosity towards white people. The question is, are you willing to save someone's life eternally by letting go of your comfort and having these conversations? Are you willing to talk about it and discuss it? I want to close with a few questions that will hopefully help us to get through and really begin to understand the atonement that needs to be made. Because guess what? Even if the church didn't get up and preach it, what's so important about that letter is that for many years, and I can tell you personally, there are certain things that were fostered, that were condoned, that were covered up, that were brushed under the rug. We cannot be a church that continues to brush things under a rug and expect people to come to Christ, to be a part of his body, to be a part of his church, when we don't have the courage to have the talk, whatever that talk is. Are we willing to not just talk the talk, but walk the walk as well? The first one is, are you willing to have life-changing conversations with people? How well do you have to know them to tell them the truth? Jesus, it is safe to say, and it is believed that he did not have a prior relationship with this man who he saw laying at the pool. It was widely known that he had been there for 38 years, but it wasn't as though Jesus and you know, they were cousins or they were close. Jesus wasn't saying, hey, come on, follow me. No, he says, do you want to get well? Do you want to be made whole? There are people that we hide behind the argument of, well, I don't really know them that well. I'm not really that close to them. I mean, I know their situation, but I don't really want to get too involved because that's not what we do. Well, here's the news. Newsflash. They didn't do that back then. They didn't involve themselves with people who were crippled, who were lame, who had leprosy, who were invalids. Jews didn't get involved with those people because in their mind there was something wrong with them. I'm not touching them. I'm not getting close to them. And yet Jesus did it. If we're to be like Christ, we have to do these things. Not, well, you know what, it would be a good idea. No, it is a must. If the church is going to survive, if it's going to grow, we have to be able to have these conversations. We have to be able to open up, even if it means that there's a risk to us. What we find in this story is that Jesus offended some people. That's why they're interrogating him later, and they were troubled. They were upset. The Jews, they were upset that Jesus thinks he has the authority to have this conversation on the Sabbath. Jesus wasn't a rebel rouser. He wasn't some, you know, social justice warrior. But he spoke the truth. Are we willing to have these life-changing conversations with people? And how well do you have to know a person to be willing to have that conversation? Second thing is God's presence relevant if you're unwilling to talk about uncomfortable truth? What is a relevant conversation today? What is a relevant conversation? And I ask that because, again, in talking about my son, I can't just come at him and talk to him about things that matter to me or in a way that resonates with me. The Bible tells us that, he said, I became all things to all men so that I might save a few. Becoming all things to all men means that we have to be willing to engage in relevant conversations that may not necessarily apply to us. What was so impactful about this letter that this guy wrote to his now deceased friend Roy, he talks about how Roy had to adapt and conform and learn the language and the culture and the system in order to belong, but nobody felt compelled to do the same for Roy. Do we feel compelled to get outside of what is comfortable for us to have a conversation and deal with things that maybe would resonate to them? And if so, or rather, if not, if we're not willing to do that, how then can the church ever be relevant? How then can we expect more people to hear the gospel if we're not willing to approach them and tell them, get off your mat and walk. You can do this. I'm empowering you. I'm willing to help you. Let me show you a way that you can get past your anger and your hurt and your resentment and your mistrust and those scars and emotional bruises and the hurts that you've had to endure your whole life. You had abusive parents. You know, you've been through a divorce. You were sexually assaulted. You've experienced racism. You've experienced police brutality. You know, fun fact, short little nugget here. Just yesterday, as I was going to pick up a couple of things for the cookout yesterday, I got pulled over right down the street. You know, it was interesting. I asked my wife last night. Now, keep in mind, I've been here almost 7 years. It'll be 7 years next month since we've been here in Delaware. I've been pulled over exactly twice. Yesterday was the second time. Now, contrast that to the countless times I got pulled over when I was in Ohio. That's why I'm here in Delaware. I get pulled over, and the guy pulls me over, and he says, so I'm pulling you over because your tags are expired. I said, well, you know, with COVID-19, I did go in to get my tags, but there were some things that I had to do, fairly simple, but it's been hard to get somebody to do it. They said, great. And I said, they told me that they were not actually giving people citations for this until after June, once the state opens back up. He says, yeah, you're right. Give me your license and insurance. And he takes it back. And I guess he reads through and goes through whatever he finds. He finds out that I am who I say I am. He comes back and he says, I appreciate your honesty. Thank you for that. You know, this is just a warning. Don't worry about it. You said you're going to get it fixed. I trust you. Go ahead and get it fixed. Have a good day. And then he goes on. And before I even pull off, he whips around, U-turn, he pulls somebody else over. Now, here's the thing. I asked my wife, I asked Sharice, were you afraid? Were you nervous? Because she's been with me through so many different being pulled over, being arrested, being handcuffed, being taken to jail. She's actually seen this stuff happen to me. She's been there for it. And I asked her, because I'll be honest with you, of all the times I've been pulled over in my 44 years on this planet, this was probably the most relaxed I've ever been. And you might think, well, should you be? With everything that's going on? Yes. And it wasn't because I hadn't done anything wrong. Guess what? I hadn't done anything wrong the last, you know, most of those times. I mean, there have been a couple times I was speeding, but the fact is, I generally have not done anything that warranted being scraped up on the ground and thrown up against a car and cuffed and knees in my back. This is not just TV for me. This is not just something I see on Fox or CNN. This is actually happening to me. But I was totally relaxed. But here's the thing. I asked my wife. She said, yeah, I was nervous. I'm always nervous. I'm always escalated because nothing has to happen for them to take your life. We watch, and just as I was going to bed last night, I see that they're literally a place that I used to stop all the time in downtown Atlanta, right off of 75, University Avenue. They're burning down a Wendy's, and everybody's rioting. They're upset. Why? Because just the night before, on his daughter's birthday, a man who's going through the drive-thru falls asleep while he's in the drive-thru. People are going around him, falls asleep in the drive-thru, and they call the police, and the police show up. And after going back and forth with him, they decide they're going to arrest him because they believe he is drunk. And he doesn't want to be arrested. And so he starts to run away after this little skirmish they had. He starts to run away, and as he's running away, he has a taser. I guess he grabbed one of the tasers, and he's, you know, running away. He's kind of like this. If you want to see the video, if you care to, he's shooting the taser back. The cop shoots him in the back. Now, here's the thing. You know, there are some who will be like, oh, well, you know what? He's drunk. Or, you know, they believed he was drunk. He didn't pass a sobriety test. There's some saying he didn't even get one. That's not even the point. The point is that I'm in this church. This is a conversation that I don't even have to have. I know what happened. And the people that could be in this church, not because they're black, not because they're white, not because they're young or old, but because they need Jesus, they won't be able to find Jesus here because they're not going to come here because we have to first be willing to engage and have that conversation. Because it's a relevant conversation. Even if you don't think it's relevant to you, it's relevant to everyone else around you. We can't just have the conversation that people want to have. Am I someone that is willing to be open about my past mistakes, hurts, and issues in order to save the church from mediocrity and irrelevance? Who is my Roy? I say this simply to say that as I was talking to my son, there were a lot of flashbacks that I had about a lot of mistakes that I made, a lot of sins that I committed. And while we didn't get into all of it while we were at Home Depot, I know that conversation's coming. I know that time is coming. Why? Because he's going to get older. He wants to understand. The fact is, people grow up and they have hormones and it's going to be racing and he's going to have questions and he's going to get his little heart broken. You know, he's going to have a girlfriend at some point and then she's going to decide it's going to happen. Am I willing to have that conversation with him and be vulnerable? Because people don't want to come in here and hear that we're all perfect. First of all, they know we're not all perfect. But they don't want to come in here and feel like everybody in the church is so perfect and I'm so flawed. They need to know that we are just as imperfect as they are. That we're just as flawed. And that through Christ, we found forgiveness, that we've overcome. But we have to be willing to have that conversation as well. Who is your Roy? Who are you willing to learn from your past and say, I'm no longer going to continue that way. I'm going to be different in how I engage in these relationships. And finally, when will we as a church decide to not only be open to the idea of taking up our mat, but actually stand up and lead? I ask this question because as a church, we're not just seeking relevance. We're not just trying to reach young people. We're not just trying to reach the lost and those who are distant from God. But this is an opportunity. Coronavirus is an opportunity. Social injustice and civil unrest and protest, these are opportunities for the church to be what God intended for us to be anyway. That place where you can find forgiveness. That place where you can find hope. That place where people will be real. That they will love you. That they will endure with you. That they will persevere with you. That they will show you what it really means to have the love of Christ in your life. This is an opportunity for all of us. Not just to be open to it, but actively do it. To actively stand up and take up our mat. And no longer languish in mediocrity, but be radical. Radical doesn't mean, you know, tearing down the walls and building a gym. Radical doesn't mean changing the music. Radical means being willing to talk about what matters to these people who are lost and don't know who Christ is. Are we willing to do that?